Before introducing our speaker tonight, I would first of all like to introduce a couple of new members. So these are the couple of new members who said they were coming tonight and put their names on the list. So when I read your name out, if you're here, just put your hand up so we know who you are, will you? If you're not, don't put your hand up. Gary Neat and Stephen Spargo. He's one of those ones not putting his hand up. But thank you, Stephen. We look forward to seeing you. I'd also like to welcome this evening particularly Geoffrey Ewing, who is the president of the Queensland branch of the Institute of International Affairs. So thank you for coming along, Geoffrey, and it's great to have you here. It's also great to have our speaker here. He told me before that he was irresponsible. I asked him if he'd like a drink, and he said, no, he said, I'm irresponsible, you know, but I'm not that irresponsible. So that's why he's drinking water. Mr. Akbar is he's one of the best-known journalists in India, the editor of India Today, which has a circulation of over 1.1 million readers in India, and I suspect a similar number around the world. He has been a Member of Parliament. He's worked in government. He's an author of many books. And is an expert on many things. He's written particularly on issues relating to the Muslim-Hindu divide in India, and is himself a prominent Muslim scholar and journalist. He's here as a guest of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and we welcome him. I hope, going to go back with a lot of good ideas for the Indian side on how we can get our relationship running better, and I hope he's going to tell us how we can do the same thing. So I'm going to ask him to speak, and it'll be the usual process that he will speak for around half an hour, and then we'll have time for questions. So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Mr. Akbar.
Thank you very, very much. Not only for your generous introduction, but for your very warm welcome to a person who's late. I can see patience was getting thinning a bit by the time we got here. We had the usual explanation, weather, but great to be in Melbourne. Last time I was here was nearly two decades ago, and I faintly remembered a city with a lot of heart and a lot of brick, and it's very, very reassuring to find both right here. Still got brick instead of cement. The subject that we have today becomes slightly easier to discuss if you see the map to your right. The geopolitics of India remains one of the most fascinating areas of study, not least because in terms of time it extends back to as far as written history has been recorded. The geopolitics of much of the world actually is far younger. America is obviously younger, Australia is obviously younger, but even Europe is much younger than the geopolitics of this region. At the very start, what is the most startling aspect of that map? And this perhaps is something that you would consider. See the great mound of brown between India and China. It's an extraordinary. People think of the Himalayas, but they don't really realize. They think of the Himalayas as a mountain range. It isn't a mountain range. It's a huge landmass of mountains. So therefore, when we discuss India, I'd like you to consider one unusual thought. China is not a neighbor of India. China and India could be in completely different continents. They are, therefore, have been historically actually quite indifferent to each other, although in the age of an empire, between them they represent two of the greatest success stories in economic terms. In 1750, I use that date deliberately, because by any rough calculation, 1757 is considered the start of the age of colonization in India, because 1757, a small battle in Bengal was lost to Robert Clive. But actually, in fact, the age of colonization started in 1765 when Major Henry Munro defeated the combined armies of Delhi and Bengal and Lucknow and Awadh. That is when the British Empire got its sanad, or got its order to be the rentier, or the landlord of the whole of Bengal. But in 1750, India had 24% of world manufacturing output. Britain had 1.8. China had 32% of world manufacturing output. Between India and China, we had more than half. This book, this is one of the themes of Paul Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of Nations. Between them, we had half of world manufacturing output. And I think in another 30 years, we'll go back to that figure. And yet, even then, India and China had such limited exchange between them that when a monk, a scholar, came to India, it was recorded from China, it was recorded as a great event. India's, I just wanted to complete one statistic just to explain what colonization means. In 1947, when the British left India, Britain had 24% of world manufacturing output and India had 1.8. It was as neat a reversal of statistics as I have ever seen. And that actually confirms yet another very strong view of mine, that nobody comes to conquer a poor country. It's only the wealth of a nation that attracts people, and for obvious reasons. After all, the returns on conquest must be worth the investment in the army. India's natural geopolitical hinterland has also not been very consistent. I wonder how many of you have gone to Kampuchea. One of the most remarkable facts, I mean, apart from this tale, I mean, I was just telling Amanda that the two places which I have visited, which left me, I mean, completely psychologically devastated, one was Auschwitz and the other was Cambodia. It is almost impossible to believe that human beings could indulge even if half of what we hear is true, it's almost impossible. It is impossible to believe. But if you go there, and you go to the Museum of Siem Reap, and if you go to the temples of Kampuchea, you will get an extent of what India's geopolitical space was 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. The most stunning representations of the Mahabharata are on a panel that it still has managed to survive, imagine, after all these ravages in Siem Reap, which extends, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, I didn't measure it, if it did not extend 300 or 400 yards, a whole wall. And it has the most brilliant, unbelievable representations of Mahabharata. And just if you think that India's influence and Australia's influence were not in a dovetail, all you have to do is come to Bali. The statuary of Bali, right today, Bali is a Muslim majority area, Indonesia is a Muslim majority area. But the statues there at every crossroads of Bali are statues representing Arjun and the great Mahabharata war, the epics. In the museums of Kampuchea, you can see the Sanskrit that has been written of these passages, and it lends me to believe, I'm not no expert in that, that the influence of India was not the influence of weapons, arms and armies, but the more enormous and more powerful influence of language. This was the power of Sanskrit that had reached there. But in about 1,000 years ago, or 1500 years ago, because the first Central Asians to come to India were the Kushans, India has been an idea which the West has been searching for from the time of Alexander. In fact, one of the reasons why Alexander returned to Greece was because he was told that the end of the world was beyond India and didn't want to check it out. But so India has been an idea which the world has been searching for. Interestingly, India has never searched for the world. It has remained content in itself because very few places were richer than India. So there was nothing worth conquering. The geopolitics of India changes about 1,000 years ago with the arrival of not merely Central Asians, the Turco-Afghans, but by the fact that they create permanent empires. They are not raiders anymore. They are not interventionists anymore. They create empire. And to cut a story that will take a very long time to unfold, we come to the realization that the modern age of India, if the beginning of that modern age is 1947. 1947 is an extremely important year in the history of the world because 1947 was the year in which India defeated European colonization and did so through methods that were considered so unusual that the world is still a bit stunned by them, the principal method being non-violence. But the Indians, who never used violence against the British, who turned out to be very violent against each other. And in 1947, India not only defeated, after all, if European colonization begins with the conquest of India, European colonization also ends with the defeat of the British in India. That defeat was accompanied by the vivisection, the partition of India. Just a stray question, what did Gandhi do on 15th August 1947? We all know what Nehru did. Nehru gave a speech whose notes were made on his way to Parliament on the back of an envelope. But it remains one of the most stirring speeches in the history of India, the Tryst with Destiny speech. But more important, what did Gandhi do? Nehru did not deliver the freedom of India, if any one person can claim that. If, and he never did claim it actually, because he realized that the freedom of India was a national enterprise. It was Gandhi. What was Gandhi doing? When BBC asked Gandhi, how did it feel on 15th August? He said, I have no feelings left. I have nothing to say. Because to him, the miracle of Indian victory had been tarnished by the defeat of the idea of India and the creation of a separate nation for Muslims in the northwest, Pakistan. In geopolitical terms, the creation of Pakistan represented a dramatic change. Such a dramatic change that we ourselves in India took a long while to understand the implications of that change. Since 47, Indian space, Indian geopolitics has been blocked to the West, physically blocked to the West. The Pakistan is the second wall that is almost as broad, well not, even if it is only half as broad as what the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas are. But India actually is a land which is blocked to the north by the Himalayas and to the west by Pakistan. And therefore, you might think that it is an obvious, but nations take a long while when tectonic change takes place of such a kind to adjust themselves to it. And therefore, India really has no practical option to go anywhere except back to the East. This Eastern momentum of India took a long while to find first expression. After all, an idea first has to find expression and then it slowly gets converted into policy. I'm sure all of you sitting here have dealt with policy, foreign or domestic, and know that between an idea and the delivery, the labor pains can be huge. We began our foreign policy thinking, Jawaharlal began our foreign policy thinking, on a preposterously sentimental note. What was the sentiment in 1947? We actually believed that since the age of colonization was coming to an end. The age of war was also coming to an end. After all, colonization was the principal source of World War, the conquest of... Why did we call World War I or World War II, which were essentially European wars, world wars? Because they were wars for the conquest of the world, or for the control of the world. From that emerged the non-aligned movement. A non-aligned movement, once again, its origins lie at the doorstep of Australia, in a city called Bandung. Right here, 1956. The five principles, or the Panchsheet of Bandung, had an enormous impact. It was a comfortable and comforting idea, and very soon we realized that it had no relationship with reality. By 1962, the two principal figures of Bandung, and I don't include Sukarno among them, the two principals of Bandung, Jawaharlal Nehru and Chou Enlai, they were the two stars. One of whom refused to speak too much, and the other of whom, who is my hero, Jawaharlal Nehru, perhaps spoke too much. By 1962, India and China were at war. And if the two leaders of the non-aligned movement, Bandung principles, could not implement the principles in their relationship, it was very obvious that these ideas were not going to travel very far. And the world began to abandon the non-aligned movement. Today, it is a very friendly club for free travel and for the occasional drink in the evening for those who know the pleasures of life. This basic mistake that was made by India was the non-recognition of a fact. In 2 years from now, you will be remembering the beginning of World War I. I urge you, as 2014 comes by, 2015 January comes in, and you remember, think back to your grandfather's generation. I suppose that's about it. And think back of them as young people in having coffee in Melbourne, or having something better in Melbourne, and discussing their future. And if anyone had said that in 3 years' time, 5 years' time, Australians and New Zealanders would pay a heavy price in a place called Gallipoli, he would have been sent to the nearest mental asylum. Try this. Stand on the edge of a decade and think ahead, and do the most bizarre plotting of the future. You will find the truth outstrips reality. Sorry, reality outstrips your imagination. The First World War, the Second World War, both segued into the Third World War. That is now common assessment. The Third World War, first was a war against German militarism, second was a war against German Nazism, the third was a war against Soviet or Russian communism. And that moved into the Fourth World War, which is the war against terrorism. And these wars are all interlinked. It is very easy. In every textbook you'll find now that the consequences of the First World War and the Versailles Treaty led directly to the Second World War. The Second World War led directly and almost immediately to the Third World War. Because the terms of possession in Europe were not accepted by the two victors of the Second World War. They wanted more space for themselves. And the Second World War, the Third World War, and then comes the Fourth World War, and this gives us to a very neat somersault, a historical somersault. Because whereas the First World War ended in 1919, the Second World War ended in 1945, and the Third World War ended, in my view, certainly with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. The First World War actually hasn't ended. The consequences of the churn of the Ottoman Empire have revived that war and then merged into this war on terrorism. Pakistan created a foreign policy that in the beginning was extremely rational. It is far more practical than Jawaharlal's foreign policy. What was this based on? Brilliant. I mean, Jinnah actually was the man who laid down the foundations of that policy. And as you look back historically, you realize that he really had a brilliant mind. He said at that moment that Pakistan now has inherited the responsibilities of the British Empire in the great game. of Central Asia, and in the southward expansion of Moscow, whether under Tsars or whether under Stalin or whether under Stalin's successors. But that Pakistan, as the guardian of the West, in a very sensitive place, did not have the capacities, either the bulk, the strength, or the financial capacities of the British Empire. And therefore, if the West wanted to fight its wars through Pakistan, then it had to support, arm, defend, as well as turn the Pakistani army. They used it brilliantly because they used the arms of the West in order to actually fight India. They never ever opened a front against the Soviet Union. They were very wise. Now, the first post-colonial war that took place in the world, which also defines the region, was the war that Pakistan started against India over Kashmir. It took place, it's quite remarkable actually, if you look back into it, into history, because it took place within 6 weeks of the formation of the nation. I mean, those 6 weeks were perhaps the bloodiest 6 weeks, certainly in the subcontinent. Millions of people were dying, refugees, resettlement, just about everything that go wrong. The nations did not have a treasury, a proper treasury. There were no revenues. I mean, it was everything that would possibly be wrong was wrong, and yet it never stopped Pakistan from launching the first war of post-colonial times within the colonies, a war that began in 47. October and hasn't stopped. I won't go into the details of why that war was launched, because that really takes us into another territory. But again, for a variety of reasons, including particularly this war, as I said, the West was blocked. In the age of terrorism, or in the age of the Fourth World War, the significant difference between the first three wars and the fourth war is the central battlefield of the first three wars was Europe, but the central battlefield of the fourth war is actually South Asia. In the fourth war, India now, almost psychologically, as it looks west and finds Pakistan a specific, those of you, by the way, who think that India is doing something very awful by having an equation with Iran, please reconsider your views immediately. India has absolutely no option except to befriend Iran, because it has no other geographical route to Afghanistan. It has no other geographical route to Central Asia, because the land, Pakistan blocks all Indian trade and traffic through its territory to Afghanistan. And while America always gives us advice about how we should deal with Iran, it never uses its influence over Pakistan to give us transit rights. And India will not surrender. After all, I'm very happy to say that Indian foreign policy and Indian's perception of the world will be determined by Indian interests, not America's or anyone else's for that matter. It took up to the first 30 years, 40 years, it took the 90s for India to realize, for India to shift its horizons. The first challenge before the Indian state was really the challenge of famine. Famine was an instrument of British policy, as much in Ireland as it was in India. By the 60s, we had managed to bring famine under control. By the 70s and 80s, we had managed to begin. Perhaps we lost 15, 20 years under the pseudo-socialism of Mrs. Indira Gandhi. Nehru was not a socialist. Nehru was a pragmatic person, very much a third path person. But by 90s, when the pseudo-socialism of Mrs. Gandhi, or populism really, had failed, it was apparent that India needed a new economic policy. Number two, by that time, the critical realities had changed in the region. Southeast Asia, which in the 50s was actually poorer than India, had found remarkable economic bounce. And this economic bounce became a natural region for India to approach. If you look at Australia, the problem that Australia had as it began to find its place gradually into a post-colonial foreign policy was how far to step away in terms of security from the mother lode. The mother lode first being the British Empire, of which it was a proud part. And that guaranteed, after all, its security. It guaranteed its security vis-a-vis Japan, vis-a-vis any potential marauder. But as British Empire collapsed and could no longer hold its own, I suppose the message of Singapore may or may not have been felt in 1942 in London, but it was certainly felt here. And as Singapore further transgressed into the loss of Hong Kong, you would see that the British were not being able to hold the Indian Ocean together, or the Asian Pacific Ocean, or whatever you want to call it, together. But that space was immediately transferred to America. And as it was transferred to America, the world, which had gone through direct colonization, was deeply suspicious of neo-colonization. That was the problem in India-Australia relations. We didn't know whether you were moving from colonization. Now, neo-colonization is very easily defined. It is a grant of independence on the condition that you do not exercise it. All over the Arab world, it's all neo-colonies. They do not have independence ever, anywhere. But this neo-colonization is built on a very interesting relationship, which was again perfected through the princely order, princely states in India, in which the empire, British Empire or any other empire, guarantees the survival of families which have been handed over nations. And the families in turn guarantee the security of the empire's interests, which is all of the Arab world, most of the Arab world. But this, it took a while, both, and I think perhaps it is this century in which the fog began to lift. And we can see the fog lifting in both directions. One, India beginning to reorganize itself as a Southeast Asian nation, or as one of the bridgeheads of the Southeast. And Asia beginning to rediscover itself as an Asian nation, as a bridgehead of this relationship. Now, these bridgeheads are not one-dimensional. Just because India becomes a bulwark, let us say theoretically, of the bridge between India and Australia. Both India and Australia have a bridge which looks in two directions. There is, India will look to Europe for its both its strategic relationship as well as its economic relationship. And Australia will continue to look at America. For a long while, this Janus-faced reality was a problem, because there were deep suspicions, in the Indian mind at least, of American interests, American aggression, American... But fortunately, for the India-Australia relationship, an amazing change occurred in the India-US relationship. And that helped eliminate the deep levels of, well, not suspicion, that would be too strong a word in the relationship, but still, some reserve that never allowed the two nations, which were natural democracies, which had a history, which were united by language, if nothing else. In India, India's attitude to the English language is very interesting. We laugh and cry in Hindi, Tamil, Urdu, or Marathi, but we rule the country in English. That is why in India, you can't find a soap opera in English. On the other hand, you can't run Delhi in Hindi. Still, the important thing was that language was a bond between India and Australia, and understanding each other. There was a middle classes which could share communication, which is one of the most important elements of any relationship. It would be actually more accurate to say that India is closer to America today than it is to Pakistan. It probably, in time terms also, it's easier to reach America than it is to reach Pakistan from India. So, this natural relationship, which should have discovered and should have, was prevented. And just, I hope I'm not overstepping my time. I'll just take a few minutes. Yeah, I'll just try and end, complete the circle. Now, Now that you have finally granted us the status of independence and given us uranium and removed the last, I would like to actually tell you and make this very strong assertion that the Indo-US nuclear deal is not the most important thing to have happened in Indo-US relations. Those who have followed it intricately will be surprised, because this was the deal that, after all, has established the partnership as a strategic partnership between the two nations. But that wasn't it. The most important thing that has happened in between India and USA is the trial of a person in Chicago whose name you do not know. His name is David Headley. One of his names is David Headley. He has a second name, also officially Dawood. His mother is an American, his father is a Pakistani. He lived in America, he was born in America. But he was among the most wanted people on America's list after the Bombay terrorism attacks. But he was among the people who actually went and did reconnaissance in Bombay. He was part of, he was one of the instrumental figures in the plot. And he's been on a wanted list for heaven knows, at least since then. He is on trial in Washington. In Chicago, for terrorism. As you know from your experience of America, America is not in the business of generosity. It does not go putting people to jail for some other nations. He's on trial in Chicago because he's America's enemy. Because he's on America's wanted list. So finally, India and US have discovered something extremely important in any strategic partnership. They've discovered an enemy in common. A strategic partnership is not based, as we found out in the 50s and 60s, through the failure of the non-aligned movement. It is not based on the search of common friends. It is based on the existence of common enemies. For the first three world wars, the West, I define that term loosely because Australia was also and is also a part of that West. The West could fight its wars, its world wars, effectively and bring them to a conclusion within at least a foreseeable time dimension. The Cold War was the longest. It took 50 years. But even then, that came to an end. And what was the reason for that? The reason was the strategic partnerships that America had, if you take America as the lead player, had in those wars were rational. They were justified by the fact if Britain was the principal strategic partner of America, then it was a rational relationship because Britain believed in the cause that it was fighting. Whether it was against German militarism, whether it was against Nazism, or whether it was against Soviet communism. Britain. But in the Fourth World War, your principal strategic partnership is not with Britain. It is with Vichy France. It is with the France of Marshal Pétain. And I'd give you this example. If Marshal Pétain had been your partner in that war instead of Charles de Gaulle, would the landings in Normandy have ever succeeded? No. Information would have gone to Berlin. The Pakistan army, with whom you have established a strategic partnership in this war, is the Vichy France, is the government. It looks in both directions. It is playing the game in both directions. And that is the principal reason why you are unable to move forward. The Britain of this war is actually India. And for more reasons than one, including the fact that it was fighting the war before America entered it. It had recognized this problem because it was a victim of this problem. It had recognized the need to stand up for this problem because it had corrosive implications for the future and the present of India. The theme of, I've happy that I'm here as a guest of the Australian government, but the principal additional reason why I'm here is to be at the Adelaide Book Festival, where the Australian edition of my new book, Tinderbox, is being officially released. I hope it's all in the bookshops already, so you can go out and buy it immediately. The subtitle of the book is The Past and Future of Pakistan, not the present. And it's an examination of the idea of Pakistan. and how Pakistan has become a jelly state. What is a jelly state? A jelly state is a state that will never be stable, nor will it disappear. Butter disappears. A jelly doesn't disappear. And because it is riddled with Islamic fundamentalism, and because it is a nuclear state, it is going to be a toxic jelly state, with implications not only for the region, but with implications for the whole world, because nuclear power is not, has no geography. So within this quivering nation, which was created for the security of Muslims, but has become the one country or one region in the world where more Muslims are dying every day than in the rest of the Muslim world put together. And those Muslims are not being killed by non-Muslims. They are being killed by fellow Muslims. Why? The consequences and the meaning of this. The blockage to the West, in India's terms, India's need for the East. So I really do believe that we are on the cusp of a completely new relationship, in which, by a volition of history, by a volition of need, by the compulsion of circumstances, India and Australia will be the polar points of a relationship. This pole will bounce westwards from India towards Europe, maybe circumventing Africa. From your side, it will bounce across the Pacific and towards Washington. It will fit, but it is this partnership which will actually conduct the most important requirement of the next 10 years, not wars alone, but a diplomatic offensive to make this region into an alliance that can take on the troubles that will not leave us alone if we don't address it. Your position in Afghanistan is only a... Don't ever really believe that you're going to get out from Afghanistan in 2014. You're not. Because if you get out from Afghanistan, then Afghanistan will get into you. Maybe on that, I shall pause and see you there.
In doing a bit of research on our speaker, I came across some comments on some of the many books that he's written. Provocative, idiosyncratic, polemical and wide-ranging, M.J. Akbar's writing reflects his depth of experience and his passion for his subject. Another one. As a wordsmith, he has no equals. He is simply the best journalist writer in India. With his latest work, he is all set to stun academics the world over with his incisive, well-researched arguments impeccably presented in faultless prose. I think you recognise the man. I would now like to call for questions, and we'll do our best to give you a reasonable group of questions. Yeah, Zara Kimpton.
Oh, Zara Kimpton from the AWA. Until the very last minute, you really did not talk at all about the Indian Ocean, and nowadays it's quite fashionable to say that this is the sort of Asian, Indo-Asian thing, era. I'm just surprised that you say that India would turn towards Europe more than, and you, at the end you said it would, Africa would not be a place of interest. But surely the whole Indian Ocean, which is in a way why we're linked, why does India not turn, you said it can't turn west, it can't turn north, but it will turn east, but can't it turn towards that whole Indian Ocean, and maybe there'd be some sort of better institutional organisation for the Indian Ocean?
I think there's a very realistic view. One of the things that we have become is a status quo power, in the sense that we no longer have any aggressive desire to take a neighbor's land away, irrespective of disputes with China, Pakistan, and so on. We could very happily settle on the status quo. But one of the signs of great maturing of Indian foreign policy is that it has understood the limitations of the leap. If you ask for too much without being ready for it, you will get nothing. You can break a leg as easily as you can do a dramatic leap forward. The Indian Ocean is extremely important to India. And if I didn't mention it, it was certainly remiss of me, because maybe I was it's such a vast subject to try and compress it within half an hour, 40 minutes is, you know, almost impossible. But yes, India recognizes that the only ocean in the world that is named after a country is the Indian Ocean. And there are very valid reasons for that, because these are the trade routes that were controlled by India historically, and they were still controlled by India. But the Indian cooperation in... Now, when we talk of a strategic relationship, not a partnership with China, I think there is a consensus in India that the land wars with China across the Himalayas will probably not recur again. One, the Indian armed forces will not be defeated so easily as they were in 62. Our arsenals are no longer full of the view that India really doesn't need an army. These are thoughts that were expressed in the age of great liberalism. India will defend and protect its territory. But a strategic need for defense, defense is no longer about threats or about aggression. Defense is all about preventing aggression. And this is where the rise of China becomes one of the areas that will impel India towards the Indian Ocean. India has just signed strategic agreements not only with Afghanistan, which may be a bit of a misnomer in real terms, but I think perhaps the most important thing it has done is sign the agreement with Vietnam. And that agreement with Vietnam has a practical value to it, because it is Indian companies who are drilling for oil in islands that Vietnam controls but China claims. Every 3 months, Beijing actually puts out some form of an official statement saying how the evil Indian machinists, splittists, slavists, whatever it is new in their dictionary, are destroying the peace of the region. It doesn't stop India from drilling for oil. So an equation is being built quietly, non-aggressively, India, Vietnam, Australia, America, Japan, all to protect interests which we consider to be international, and all to protect interests from being submerged in the rising China wave that is becoming visible, at least to the neighborhood. Nations in Southeast Asia do feel vulnerable. They may not totally express it, but they do feel vulnerable. And India is developing the military strength to become one of the members of the guardian force in this region.
I was very interested in your comment about Iraq. Now, I'm surprised that you would want to build Afghanistan for a start. What would India's interest be in Afghanistan? I know there's supposed to be a lot of minerals there, but why would you want to go through Iraq? And secondly, if you look at the map, I mean, India really is pretty isolated. You've got wherever you are, and you've got a Turkey moving up to try and make relations with all the Turkic people around in the north there. And thirdly, if I can comment, that you must be very surprised now, or we all are, that Anthony Eden in 53 or 4 claimed Pakistan as one of the neutral Islamic states to join the Baghdad Pact.
Well, in 1956, Pakistan actually joined not the Baghdad Pact. It actually supported the invasion of Suez in its effort to warm up, or let the West warm up to it. Why would we want in Afghanistan? A closer examination of the map would be very useful, because Afghanistan sits on the top of Kashmir. It's maybe 10 miles from the edge, you know, as Afghanistan's beak crawls up. It's next. In geostrategic terms, the Siachen Glacier is the equal playground.
And you think Iran will let you go through?
No, Iran is letting us go through. Iran, not only that, we are the principal builders of the Bandar Shah port, developed it. We've built a railway up to Herat. Our trade is going. I mean, we need trade with Afghanistan, because not only that, and we also have to worry about the day when America and Australia disappear from that region, What do we do then? We can't abandon it because we are locked there geopolitically. You have the luxury of moving away from a problem until the problem strikes you back. We don't have that luxury. So we need, it's not a secret, Pera will tell you, in the 1990s, the whole of the Northern Alliance, which you used immediately after 9/11, who were these people who were suddenly resurrected? They were people you had abandoned and who were being looked after financially as well as geographically in Delhi. Abdullah, who fought, was a foreign minister and then fought against Karzai. His whole family lives in Delhi today. So India has its own interests, legitimate interests in Central Asia, and it will not abandon them. And if it cannot find, and if the world decides that India cannot catch its nose like this, then India will catch its nose like this. Its arm is long enough and can curve. The railway line is a very remarkable achievement. It takes goods right up to Herat now, and it will move into Central Asia.
Thank you very much, Sir. My name is Hashim. I'm from Monash Asia Institute. Thank you for the fact that you're giving us background what's going on in India particularly and in Asia in general. The fact that we recognize that China and India are the two most populous nations in the world, and Uncle Sam is very worried these two nations are going to be very powerful in time to come. Australia is contributing basically with all the raw materials that we have, except for uranium, and perhaps I'm not going to get into that discussion. But the fact remains that we are contributing in a very substantial way. About 20,000 Indian students studying in Australia. And this must be taken into consideration about the skills that we're giving your people when they go back, or effectively they stay here. They are contributing to the well-being and economy of India. What do you think, in your opinion, a better way to continue this contribution?
Well, I hope all those 20,000 people are actually students and not potential immigrants. I don't think you need to come to Melbourne for cookery classes. We have some very good ones in India. And if you bring them in, well, you're most welcome, of course. I have nothing to say on the subject. But our international educational skills, Australia can play a very, very important part in the demand, the thirst, the absolute ravenous thirst for education. It is a very perfectly positioned, and that would be one of the great integrators of not two governments, because two governments always manage to, essentially that's a thin relationship until it is matched by, once again, here the power of language, because the English language is now an Indian language. So it is great potential. Certainly more Indians speak the English language than English.
I'm Ghazi from Access and the Institute. I was just wondering, given the this bridge relationship you're talking about between Australia and India, what you see as the role for organisations like ASEAN and APEC, which have been of increasing focus. What do you think the role of those sorts of organisations could play, and how this bridge might play out?
ASEAN and APEC, ASEAN at least, it is troubled by its first word. What is Asia? It's a term that is a geographical accident, but nobody has really defined what it is. Is West Asia Asia? Is Asia the territory from which Japan conquered up to the edge of India? China is China. It isn't Asia. And so on and so forth. So we have to refigure out and perhaps rename continents around alliances and coalitions. But the fact that they exist becomes an extremely useful diplomatic weapon in order to create broader alliances and broader regions. India is now, can be a legitimate, one of the great triumphs of Indian diplomacy is just about to happen, and that is the liberation of Burma from the junta. Once that happens, and I know we've all been in the past, I have been, critical of the warm relationship between the, you know, India, Delhi, and whatever their new capital is called. And, you know, they welcomed the army chiefs and so on. But that is so useful, because they've achieved, once again through non-violence, what could not have been achieved really through violence. And now you have the genuine, on the 1st of April, are the first elections in which, forgetting her full name, in which she is going to participate. And, you know, I'm sure now that she will become Prime Minister and leader of her government. When that happens, you can see the region unfold. Because the road then from Delhi, via Rangoon, via Burma, into Thailand. This year, we have a symbolic event every day, the Republic Day Parade, every year, the Republic Day Parade. And the chief guest at the Republic Day Parade is a very, very important symbol of India's immediate needs, impulsions. And the chief guest this year was the Thai Prime Minister. So, Burma, Thai Prime Minister, Cambodia, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, we're building an equation with. This is a straight line for trade, politics, commerce, and indeed for coalition building as an important factor that will dominate, I think, the next two decades.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry we have run out of time. I'd like to invite our Vice President, Dr. Tim Healy, to propose a vote of thanks.
Well, I have had the advantage of reading Mr. Akbar's CV before he arrived, and he is the most prodigious writer that I can think of. An enormous number of books have been so well reviewed. It reminded me of a comment somebody made quite recently that the only books being written in good English are those being written in India, in English language. The talk, he covered such a large amount of ground in such a short period of time, it's difficult to encapsulate it. One comment that captured my imagination was, he said, I think I got this right, India is an idea the world has been searching for. It made me think back of my own family. I know they had four great uncles who went out to India. I don't know whether they made their fortune or not, but they sort of came back with various tales. It's well before my time. That's part of colonial history. Another comment that struck me was, again historical, that Pakistan is today, has inherited Britain's position in the great game. The great game is an idea that Kipling, I think, invented the term, but it was essentially the British protecting themselves from the Russians. And so here we have the idea of Pakistan as the intermediary. And how Mr. Akbar managed to insert into his conversation on India Marshal Pétain and Vichy France was a marvel. And it's made me think very seriously about our relations with Pakistan. We are really very grateful for you for coming and talking to us, and we've really enjoyed it, and it's been a fascinating discussion. And I would like to present to you on behalf of the Institute a history of the Institute.
Thank you, sir.
And I'd invite you all to thank Mr. Akbar for his talk.